I'm Kyle Crawford. This week on War News Radio, we bring you a new program from our sister studio, the Sudan Radio Project. The UN estimates that since 2003, violence in the Darfur region of Western Sudan has left as many as 300,000 people dead and forced 2.7 million from their homes. Each month, the Sudan Radio Project aims to take a deeper look at the conflicts in Darfur and elsewhere in Sudan. Their reporting ranges from personal stories of Sudanese refugees to critical analysis of Sudan's history and political landscape. Take a listen.
You're listening to the Sudan Radio Project. I'm your host, Maria Thompson. This month, widening the lens. First, an update on the emerging obstacles to the January South Sudan referendum, coming from within Sudan and from neighboring countries. Next, we hear from a Sudanese musician living in Dubai, whose R&B hits have attracted listeners from across the Middle East. Then, a look at the work one South Sudanese organization is doing to promote HIV awareness. And last, Barry Stein, political science professor at Michigan State University, helps us to draw connections between the conflicts in Darfur and in the Congo. On January 9, 2011, a referendum is scheduled to be held in South Sudan to determine whether the region will remain a part of Sudan or whether it will secede and become an independent nation. For more background about the referendum, listen to our piece from last month's show, Entering the Arena. Over the past month, obstacles to South Sudan's referendum have been further reinforced, including the dispute regarding who will plan and vote in the simultaneous Abay plebiscite. Mina Itabashi has more.
Over the past couple of days, there have been many indications that the referendum planned for January 9th may be delayed. Tensions between the North and South still continue to intensify, especially since Southern Sudanese armed forces accused the North Sudan Armed Forces of launching an airstrike on the base of the SPLA, or the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, which is the main constituent of the currently semi-autonomous South Sudanese government. Philip Bigger, a spokesman for the SPLA, was quoted by Al Jazeera as stating that the intention of the Sudan Armed Forces was to try to disrupt the referendum process. The Sudan Armed Forces have denied the accusation. On December 1st, the tender to print ballots that had been closed in mid-November was reopened and extended for another 5 days. The following day, it was reported that voter registration is now extended until December 8th. These extensions have increased the pressure on the voting deadline, especially as logistical procedures have so far been taking a long time to be completed. For example, according to the Southern Sudan Referendum Commission, it took 5 weeks to print the registration materials, and the United Nations predicts that it will take up to 3 weeks to distribute voting materials in the South due to the lack of infrastructure. The printing of ballots is an especially sensitive topic because of the controversy surrounding the presidential elections in April of this year, during which the opposition parties accused the National Elections Commission of allowing the state's currency printing press to engage in fraud when printing the ballots. Southern officials have requested that voting materials be printed outside of Sudan to avoid manipulation. In the midst of these delays, there have been some positive progress. For example, Al Jazeera reported this week that 2.1 million people have registered to vote in the South. This amounts to 56% of eligible voters in the region and can be considered promising. The commissioner of Mayum County in the Unity State has voiced this optimism, telling the Sudan Tribune that the turnout was high, especially after the county's task force committee carried out an awareness campaign. However, numbers are less optimistic in the north, where the Sudan news agency SUNA reported on December 2nd that 26.2% of the 270,000 eligible voters have registered so far. North Sudan is also facing some disputes surrounding the Abyei referendum, which is scheduled for January 9, 2011 as well. The North Sudan-based government has called to allow the nomadic Arab tribe of Al-Masira, who travels to Abyei a few months a year, to vote in the referendum. The South, on the other hand, argues that only the indigenous tribe of Dinka Nok should be eligible to vote. The Sudan Tribune has quoted President al-Bashir declaring that North Sudan will not accept the conduction of a referendum in Abyei area that excludes the Mesirah from voting. Outside forces also seem to be working against the referendum, as revealed by a diplomatic cable recently leaked by whistleblower WikiLeaks. According to this information reported by Reuters, Egypt lobbied last year to amend the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement to give the South autonomy for 10 years before determining its independence, or delaying the referendum for around 5 years in order to give South Sudan time to develop itself. The cable quotes officials saying that Egypt predicted that the new southern Sudanese state, if formed, would fail, and this would have fatal implications, such as destabilizing the Horn of Africa, causing an influx of migrants to Egypt, hurting the Suez Canal revenue, and threatening Egypt's access to the Nile waters. The Sudan Tribune reported that with these concerns in mind, the chief of the Southern Sudan Referendum Commission has declared his intentions to ask President al-Bashir and President Mayardit of the semi-autonomous region to postpone the referendum for 3 weeks. Delaying the vote, however, could lead to violent protests in South Sudan. If violence were to erupt, the stakes are high. At the end of last month, a report titled The Cost of Future Conflict in Sudan, written by a coalition of European and African economic and political think tanks, published estimations that a return to civil war in Sudan could cost more than $100 billion over 10 years. Moreover, violence in the south could reverse the progress made by peace agreements and accords over the past decade in Sudan. For the Sudan Radio Project, this is Mina Itabashi. I woke up in the middle of the night, looked to my left, you ain't by my side. Grabbed my phone, maybe you call, maybe I just can't take no more. Where you? That was an excerpt from You Girl, a song by the Dubai-based Sudanese musician Nile.
Nile is a part of a growing community of Sudanese artists located throughout the Middle East, whose music is redefining popular styles like hip-hop and R&B. Laura Wong spoke with him about his music and life in the UAE.
Hello, Nile. It's great to speak with you. Thanks for joining us. Could you start off by introducing yourself?
My name is Nile Ahmed Khalid, also known as Nile. I'm 27 years old. I currently live in the United Arab Emirates, UAE. Originally, I come from a city called Wad Madani. It's in Sudan. It's a beautiful town on the west bank of the Blue Nile. It's southeast of the capital, Khartoum.
So you were born in Sudan, but now you live in the UAE. When did you leave Sudan?
Basically, my parents came here back in 1984. I was just 2 years old, and I've been living here ever since, except for a couple of years when, in 1999, we went back to Sudan. I joined primary school there in Sudan and came back again to UAE, and ever since I've been just going back and forth.
Would you ever go back to Sudan just to perform your music?
Yeah, of course, I'd love to. I'm a Sudanese musician, yeah. Yeah, I did a couple of interviews there in the main radios in Sudan, and also got my songs played on air, and people seem to like it. Hopefully, maybe next year I'll go to Sudan and do more radio interviews. I'll probably go to the main radios. There's the Mango radio station. There's also Channel 4 radio station.
Tell me about your music. What was it like in the beginning? What inspired you to start making music?
I used to have a band in Sudan, but that was 10 years, I guess, back. We used to do about a mixture of Sudanese and R&B music. But for some reason, the band doesn't exist anymore. And ever since, I went on my own and started doing my own music. I found out that R&B music is what I'm really good at. So I started writing and started making my own music, making my own beats. When she said stop, baby go slow, had me standing on my tippy toes. When she said stop, baby go slow, had me standing on my tippy toes. When she said stop, baby go slow.
So you started making music 10 years ago?
When I was 16, singing first, and then I started to play the guitar. From then on, I went to making beats till I joined a college here in Dubai, where I took a diploma of audio engineering. Technically, yeah, I'm an audio engineer.
So you're a performer and a producer. Do you do a lot of music production?
Well, I started with my own music, of course, but I've been trying to make some music for a couple of musicians here. Some of them are friends. There aren't many Sudanese musicians in Dubai right now. I haven't met a lot of them. Maybe a couple, yeah. Maybe a couple that I've worked with. But not professionally, not yet.
Speaking of technology, a lot of musicians these days from all over the world are using the internet to gain publicity. Have you used new media at all to promote your music?
Yeah, of course. Definitely more exposure for me. I started with uploading my tracks on the Facebook page. And then I went to the YouTube page when I did these live clips, short clips. And it definitely helped a lot. Made people see the live part of the music. And definitely got me more exposure.
So where do you get your inspiration from?
Living here in the UAE, Dubai is a metropolitan city where a lot of nationalities from all over the world. Whenever you go to clubs, whenever you gather with people, this is all that you listen to. You listen to R&B, you listen to hip-hop, you listen to pop music in general. So this is where I was actually inspired and loved the music and start to make my own.
I know you mostly perform R&B. Is this the kind of music that's popular in Sudan?
Yeah, for the younger generation, of course it is. Yeah, especially like the media and these days. It's like satellite radios and everything that's available. And yeah, it's quite popular in Sudan.
Is it mostly American hip-hop that makes it big in Sudan these days?
Yeah, of course. That's where the R&B music was originated, basically, in America, yeah. I've been listening to a lot of R&B since back in the day, growing up. I used to listen to a lot of Babyface, Blackstreet, and soul music, Boyz II Men also.
What is it about R&B that you find so powerful?
I just love the sound. I just love the music. I think because it's real. That's all. I think it's just the normal situations that we're all going through. And it's just real life situations. Everyone loves music, and it's just a better way to express whatever that's on your mind and experience what people are going through.
Do you have a favorite song that you've written?
I'd say Lonely. It's about the situation where everyone can go. When you're lonely, when whatever, you got your heart broken. And... Hey. Mm-hmm.
Said that you're lonely, why don't you call me? Baby, I'm only phone call away.
Thanks so much for speaking with us, Niall.
Thanks a lot, and thank you for having me.
To hear more of Niall's music, check out his Facebook page or his upcoming website, nileofficial.com.
It's been a long time, baby. Don't act like you don't really care. You know it ain't over. Won't you come over, baby, and let me love you the way you like, baby. Ooh, wait to be next to you and do all the things we do, babe. Your body's calling me. Won't you just let it be tonight.
The civil war between North and South Sudan officially came to an end in 2005, but for impoverished South Sudan, many challenges remain. According to the UN, South Sudan is in the midst of an HIV/AIDS epidemic. This has recently been a hot topic among the health authorities in the regional government, with World AIDS Day having just passed on December 1st. Southern Health Minister Dr. Tombe declared that the war against HIV/AIDS is a unifying war, as it does not discriminate against tribe, region, or gender. Shilpa Bopana spoke with Dr. Ali Ahmed Ramadan, a doctor who works in South Sudan with the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, about what his organization is doing to raise awareness and prevent the spread of this deadly disease.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Ali Ahmed Ramadan. It's so good to have you with us. So, news reports are saying that the HIV/AIDS epidemic in South Sudan is pretty serious. 3% of the population is living with HIV or AIDS, and in some regions, it's up to 10% or more. But for a long time, the international community was focusing on the civil war and getting together the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. When did people like healthcare professionals and NGOs start noticing that the problem was this critical?
Before the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which was in 2005, there was no organized response to HIV and AIDS within South Sudan. But after the CPA was signed, quite a number of organizations with interest in health came in, and the government of South Sudan also came in place. And so there came a situation where coordinated efforts to have a centralized response to HIV and AIDS started.
And so HIV/AIDS Alliance is one of those organizations. What's the approach that you found to be the most effective?
Alliance basically picked HIV and AIDS as one of its core focus areas. But beyond HIV and AIDS, we do capacity building of the community-based organizations, which could be youth group, women group, people living with HIV, AIDS association, faith-based groups. We try and support organizations to have offices, equipment, and infrastructure. And then we give technical capacity support in terms of the critical areas, let's say HIV/AIDS awareness, condom use and education, awareness for voluntary counseling and testing, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, all the technical areas. So it's a unique approach that South Sudan has been lacking, and we feel proud to be part of an organization that does that in South Sudan.
So alongside the capacity building, is there any specific strategy that you emphasize the most?
In South Sudan, we believe as Alliance, people are still going to have sex whether you tell them about HIV or not. So we create demand for condoms. And how we do that, we teach people about condoms, their use, storage, bozo, and then try to create demand for it. And we hope that in the near future, condom use would be one of the ways of preventing HIV and AIDS in South Sudan.
Okay, so in trying to reach out or trying to educate people about condom use and HIV, are there any people that you're targeting specifically? And also, which groups are most at risk for contracting HIV?
At the very top were the uniformed forces. And Sudan has quite a lot of those ones because of the nature of the long and protracted armed conflict. And then we have key sellers. We call them key sellers, but in a loose way, they are like commercial sex workers. Here, it's not very appropriate to call somebody a prostitute or a commercial sex worker, but they end up selling sex. So we identified that and also as a risk group. And then we have the internally displaced people. And then we have the children, they have street kids. The nature of their lifestyle coupled with drug abuse puts them also at risk. I think it could be more that I've not probably mentioned top of my head.
And how would you characterize the attitude in general in South Sudan towards HIV/AIDS?
Attitude, I can say it's not uniform. In cosmopolitan towns like Juba, I should say there is awareness and attitude is basically open. People are open to information, advice, and talks about HIV and AIDS. But as you go out of Juba and in some of those poorly accessed areas, there's really a big case of denial, a big case of stigma and discrimination. People say there's nothing called HIV and AIDS, just a creation of people.
Sudan is a developing country, so obviously it's still working through some difficulties in terms of infrastructure, stability, things like that. As a doctor, as a healthcare professional, what are some of the challenges that you face in trying to prevent or combat this epidemic in Sudan?
Challenges are quite a number. The need is big. South Sudan is a big, big country. Just to give you an idea, from my office, which is in Juba, up to the nearest project site that we have, takes me 4 hours if I'm driving with a very good car. If the transport is not there, then I cannot do the work. Up to recently, we didn't have national HIV/AIDS prevention policy. And so everybody comes with bits and pieces of policy statements and try to use it to the best of their ability. And so at the very end, you have these disorganized and uncoordinated activities in terms of HIV prevention that do not fit within probably what South Sudan needs.
And so are there any challenges that are unique to South Sudan?
There's a very big stigma associated with discovering that somebody is HIV positive. And that can easily be explained because of all the methods through which somebody can acquire HIV and AIDS, the one that is looked at with a lot of disdain is the sexual intercourse route. And this is an African country. Things sexual are not talked about, not discussed, and are not openly broached within this community. So that is a big, big, big problem.
Dr. Ali Ahmed Ramadan, it's been great speaking with you about your work. Thanks so much for being on the show. For the Sudan Radio Project, this is Chilpa Bepana.
Kate Eyes Bureau also contributed to this report. The conflict that has taken place in Darfur is, unfortunately, not the only one on the African continent. While it receives much less media, the Democratic Republic of Congo is also struggling with violence. While the two conflicts are separated by hundreds of miles, there are noticeable similarities between the two. Danny Herschel Burns interviewed Professor Barry Stein at Michigan State University about their connections.
Both the Darfur and the Congo conflicts involve mobile rebel groups, large-scale human rights abuses, and millions of internally displaced people, but they are by no means identical. Barry Stein, a political science professor who specializes in refugees and displaced persons, compares the similarities and differences between the two conflicts.
Okay, lots of similarities, and the major similarity is very large internally displaced persons populations. And in both cases, they've had to flee because of violence in their home areas, and they have not fled across an international boundary, so they're not refugees, they're still within their homeland. But there's a basic difference between the two. In the case of Darfur, much of the violence, if not most of the violence, has been initiated by the Sudanese government. And so the government is the persecutor in this case. And so the internally displaced persons are still in areas controlled by the government, the very party that is attacking them. In the Congo, what you have is many different warlord factions, criminal groups, and others engaged in violence. The Congolese government itself is weak and unable to stop the violence, and occasionally is a participant in the violence, but it's not the main persecutor of the displaced persons. So that would be the big difference between the two places.
The identity of the combatants and the level of violence also differ between the two countries. Stein again.
They're quite different. What you're dealing with in the Congo, in the Kivus and Oriental province, what you're dealing with are several armed groups. One group is partially made up of Rwandese Hutu, who fled from Rwanda after the Rwanda genocide. They were the ones who committed the genocide. And so that's one of the groups. Another group is a group coming out of Uganda called the Lord's Resistance Army, which operates more in Oriental province. It's an area of weak government. So armed groups of various types and militias exist there. And what you have is violence can occur at almost any time with little warning. And people flee, and they flee into the forest. They flee to areas that might have some UN protection, but extremely difficult area to operate in. In the Darfur region, the Janjaweed, the mounted nomads that are supported by the Sudanese government, they are one group. And this is confusing from the literature. There's ongoing violence in Darfur, and people are in terrible circumstances. But the worst violence ended a couple of years ago. And so a lot of the people are in refugee encampments, displaced persons camps, protected areas. Their great difficulty is, since the president of Sudan was indicted by the International Criminal Tribunal for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, he has shut down the operations of a number of aid agencies and relief agencies working to help the Darfur displaced persons. And so that makes their situation quite a bit worse.
Sudan and Congo have large amounts of displaced persons. Professor Stein gives the exact numbers.
Darfur, roughly 2 million to 2.5 million people internally displaced, and they are in the Darfur region. The Congo, you'd be talking of around 2 million internally displaced persons, and they are primarily in the eastern Congo, in the area around Kivu and the provinces further north from there.
Like Congo, the conflict in Darfur is not just confined to Sudan. Barry Stein explains the origins of the conflict and its international aspect.
The Darfur conflict originates with a couple of rebel groups trying to get attention from the Sudanese government and getting far more violent attention than they ever expected, attacking some government installations. And the government then unleashes the Janjaweed, the Arab militias on them. What you're dealing with there is some of those rebel groups have been based in Chad after they've come under attack from Sudanese forces. There are refugee camps in Chad. And so, as is typical in many refugee situations, you get violence that goes across the border, where government troops are either pursuing refugees or they are simply attacking people without any care about the border. Plus, neighbors blame neighbors for allowing these other groups to operate.
Finally, Stein prophesizes on which conflict is most likely to end first.
Simply don't know. No way to know.
You've been listening to the Sudan Radio Project. That's all for this month. Special thanks to Daniel Duncan and Nick Catino for behind-the-scenes support. The Sudan Radio Project is sponsored by Project Pericles. Learn more about us and listen to past shows at sudanradioproject.org. Thanks for tuning in.